House Revenue Committee, and welcome everybody this morning. We have just one bill in front of us today. We're going to learn all about discs and fisks and other interesting creatures that exist under federal law, or did. Lizbeth, do you have staff's report for us on this, or should we go straight to Deborah?
Chairman Shetterly and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. I'll just tell you the things that I gave you this morning. I gave you this brief history of the foreign sales corporations and extraterritorial income. I gave you the revenue impact, and then also a staff major summary. But then I also gave you this just summary. It starts with response to foreign sales corporation extraterritorial income decisions. And all this is really is from the Treasury report on the Bush plan, and this is kind of the last section in there, and at least gives you a bit of an understanding of kind of their position now with the various rulings. So I'll just go over some of the brief history then with the foreign sales corporations and extraterritorial income. And I'll just start here with federal law. You know, this is an issue that has, you know, been going on for years. At the federal level, there was a Revenue Act of 1971, which provided some of our first tax incentives for exports in creating the domestic international sales corporations, or the DISCs. And so basically with the DISCs, these were domestic international corporations, and they had to meet the requirements that, you know, like 95% or more of the gross receipts were actually export receipts. So these were basically the corporations that were set up in order to deal with the exporting component of a parent corporation. And DISCs at that time, at the federal level, did not receive any taxation at all on their income. And they lacked any physical presence at all. There was no property or payroll. They just had, like, the sales component. So basically with the DISC, those sales that were attributable to the DISC were not incorporated into the taxable income for that corporation. Then what we saw in 1976 was basically this U.S. trading partners complained to GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, about the U.S. DISC and then these unfair trading practices. So there were various negotiations at that time all about these corporations. And then what we saw was finally in 84, then the Congress enacted the foreign sales corporations. And one difference then with the foreign sales corporation is that the foreign sales corporation, just the portion of foreign trade income of the foreign sales corporation would actually be excluded from federal taxation. So that where the DISC, you know, eliminated all of the tax at the federal level, the foreign sales corporation just exempted that portion of their income that was attributable to foreign trade income. Then what we saw again in November of 1997 then was a WTO ruling that determined that the foreign sales corporation was an export subsidy and an unfair trade practice. And again, what these different international organizations were looking at was in terms of an export subsidy was, first of all, whether or not it foregoed tax revenue that was otherwise due by that corporation, and the second criteria was whether or not this tax treatment was contingent on export performance. And with the WTO, they found that this foreign sales corporation, as well as the DISC prior to 97, was contingent on export performance, and it was foregoing tax revenue, so it constituted an export subsidy, and that was their ruling. So then what we saw then was Congress passed then in 2000 in order to deal again with the WTO ruling, the Foreign Sales Corporation repeal and the Extraterritorial Income Exclusion Act. And basically with the extraterritorial income, then you no longer had to set up an actual corporation. You know, with the foreign sales corporations, they were actual, you know, physical entities in which you attributed those export receipts to. But with the extraterritorial income, this was just the gross income of a taxpayer that was attributable to the foreign trading gross receipts. So this didn't have to be a particular entity. It was just that portion of a corporation's foreign trading gross receipts. And this provided, again, a partial exemption from tax for that income from the foreign sales and leasing transactions. So with extraterritorial income, this is what we were talking about last week when we were talking about the reconnect. This is one thing that the CPAs brought forward as one of the things that we were connecting to. And then but what we've seen recently is in January of 2002 that the WTO ruled then that the U.S. exclusion of this extraterritorial income was still an export subsidy and an unfair tax treatment. So the World Trade Organization has even imposed trade sanctions against U.S. exports for $4 billion per year. And as you can see from this statement from, as I was talking about with the Bush plan, they say, you know, in the first when they're talking about the proposal, is that, you know, meeting the compliance of the World Trade Organization ruling is going to require quite a change in these extraterritorial income, you know, regulations that they have currently in place. So this is something that could be changed, you know, soon. And so as far as Oregon law, basically the history of the connection that we've had with these various DISC versus FISC versus extraterritorial income, we see that in 83, Oregon first connected to the federal definition of taxable income for corporations. And then in 85, we see that Oregon disconnected from the FISC and the DISC provisions, and Oregon added back then the income that was excluded from federal taxes. So basically since 85, you know, we haven't really been connected with these various changes between FISC and DISC because Oregon just added back that income that was then excluded from federal taxes. But now with the rolling reconnect to federal law changes and the change in 2000 with the elimination of the Foreign Sales Corporation, what we see is that Oregon can no longer add back then that portion of that income that was excluded from foreign sales corporations, and now the extraterritorial income is excluded from gross income for corporations. So that has been the end result so far. So what you see then with House Bill 2182 is that it's adding back then this extraterritorial income that is excluded from federal taxes. So basically, at the federal level, corporations, have to identify this extraterritorial income, and then this is something that from that report that they make at the federal level, that is what is then included back here in Oregon to that sales component when we're factoring their apportionment formula. So basically, just to summarize it all to make sure everybody's clear, without this bill, House Bill 2182, what you see from the revenue impact is that when you add back this additional extraterritorial income, it results in roughly in 2003-05 biennium, $18 million, and the 03-07 biennium, $30 million. So there is a pretty large revenue impact, and there is no fiscal to this bill. And
okay. Well, are we ready to just close the public hearing and go to work session on this?
No.
We can probably dispense with the testimony. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I have a question, if I could. I think I understand where you've gone with this. I got through the steps, and I finally ended up on the one that I think you ended up on. The question I have is, all that being the case, why do we care about the definition of a foreign sales corporation anymore to the point where we're willing to amend ORS 317.286 in Section 172 to describe that in a new way?
Representative Barnhart, the main thing with the bill, I mean, as far as connecting with the definition of foreign sales corporation, is because in the 2000 legislation, right, we've just repealed, you know, foreign sales corporations. Well, there are some corporations that still keep foreign sales corporations. And so we need to still connect with some definition of foreign sales corporation in the federal law. So that's why we're connecting to the pre-2000 law. But then again, when we're connecting to the extraterritorial income, you know, obviously that is something that came about from the 2000 law. change. And, so we are connecting then to that definition in current law.
And 1 sub C says we get the money.
1 sub C.
Right, lines 16 and 17 of the bill.
That's 16 and 17.
Yeah, when you're saying that there'll be no extraterritorial income, that just becomes part of the things you can exclude.
Thank you. All right.
Okay. All right. You know, well, folks, we'll hear this about 5 times today, I hope, and over time it will begin to sink in. We did get some materials as well. I know that were distributed by the Department of Revenue before today. Did everyone get copies of those? Okay. So, and I was kidding, we're not going to work this bill today. So today will be orientation on FISCs and DISCs and ET income. Deborah, do you want to come forward and give us the department's overview? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I'm glad it's okay that I repeat things because I will repeat some of what was just said. We recognize that this is a policy decision for you, and I'm not here to make a policy recommendation. That really is within your purview. All I wanted to do was give you some history and some context from the Oregon standpoint and maybe explain why we ended up with the bill in front of you. We see this as a reconnect issue, as Lizbeth said, and I think the seeds of this bill were planted 20 years ago in the 1983 legislature. They were in exactly the same position that you're in now as far as reconnect. Up until 1983, the Oregon law was automatically conforming to changes in the definition of federal taxable income. You'll hear it called automatic conformity, a rolling reconnect, a floating tie. All of them mean the same thing. And that is that as Congress made changes in the definition of federal taxable income, those were automatically adopted by Oregon. So at that time, what they were seeing was Congress increasing expenses, for example, for depreciation, exactly like you saw with bonus depreciation. They had accelerated cost recovery system that was put in, and Congress was making other changes. And the 1983 legislature was looking at that. They were watching that submarine as it dove and dove and dove, and they stood on the dinghy and said, cut the line. That's exactly what they did. They cut the line. They disconnected, which is what you discussed doing earlier this week with the Reconnect bill. They put in a fixed date of conformity to the definition of federal taxable income in 1983, and that's what we had until 1997. So how does this fit into that? In 1985, the legislature came to town, and they went over the changes that occurred in federal law since the prior session. That submarine came back up, they looked at it, and said, my, how you've changed, and we like this, but we don't like this. And one of the changes that they did not like that Congress had enacted in 1984 were the provisions dealing with foreign sales corporations. I am not an international tax attorney, and I'm hoping I don't have to answer questions about the details of how these operate. If you have questions, I'll try to get you the information. But as I understood the foreign sales corporations, what that meant was you could have a corporation that is exporting widgets, for example, and under the previous rules, that corporation, if it's all it's doing is exporting widgets, it would pay tax on the income that it gets from the sale of the widgets. The Foreign Sales Corporation rules allowed them to set up a subsidiary, and as long as it had a foreign presence and they followed all the rules, some of that income would be excluded for federal purposes. The Oregon legislature said, we don't see a need to do that. It disconnected and did not recognize the Foreign Sales Corporation provisions. So for Oregon purposes, there was an add back on the Oregon return for the exclusion that was being claimed at the federal level. And as Lizbeth said, that went on until 2000, when the Foreign Sales Corporation rules were replaced with an extraterritorial income exclusion. Now, the reason this is unusual and the reason we have the bill here is that you had made a policy decision in 1985 not to recognize the Foreign Sales Corporation provisions. What changed at the federal level was really the form of the exclusion. It took away one form and replaced it with another, but the substance didn't really change. There was a subsidy before, there was a subsidy after. But the way it was structured impacted Oregon taxes, because previously it had been a foreign sales corporation that we specifically disconnected from in Oregon law. When it changed to being an exclusion from taxable income, that automatic reconnect that we had put in place in 1997 meant that flowed through to Oregon without any action on your part. Those changes occurred at the federal level in November of 2000. That's when the Foreign Sales Corporation was repealed and replaced with the extraterritorial income exclusion. It was late, and that material was not presented to the committees in the 2001 legislature as part of the overview of federal changes like you heard from the CPAs earlier in this session. So this is the first opportunity to consider that change and make a policy decision as to whether or not you want to disconnect from that exclusion. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
All right. Questions for Deborah?
Mr. Chair, just would this take a 36 vote?
I assume it would take a 36 and 18 vote, since it would raise revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Williams.
Which, again, I think points out the challenge with being connected, that, you know, anytime you want to disconnect, it's a 36-18. As opposed to connecting, which is something you can do with 31.
Representative Barnett?
Thank you. So the second scheme is in effect now at the federal level, and therefore in Oregon because of our connection rules.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think that depends on how you count, because if you count the discs,
well, maybe it's the third
scheme.
If you go back to discs, this is number three.
This is the third scheme. Okay. But if I read the materials correctly that we've got, the WTO has already said that this is illegal too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
Okay. So at this stage, we don't know what Congress is going to do with this for the federal law purposes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. There is talk about a substantial rewrite of the international tax rules.
I think that's another indicator, Mr. Chair, of support for for Representative Williams' recent comment.
What else? Really? Okay.
Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Berger.
Let me indulge me just a minute, please, and explain again. This bill connects or disconnects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, this bill disconnects from the extraterritorial income exclusion that is available at the federal level and that automatically flows through to Oregon. It restores the taxability of the same type of income that you had prior to 2000.
Okay, so it is a disconnect.
Yes.
And it requires two-thirds?
Three-fifths.
Mm-hmm. To disconnect.
Right. In this case, it does, because to disconnect results in increased revenues to the state. It's an interesting conundrum, because this is an area where the state had expressly made a policy decision not to go with the Foreign Sales Corporation, and then the federal government, in response to the WTO, as you say, they repealed the FSC law, replaced it with this exclusion, and in doing that, I guess, effectively just redefined taxable income, put it into this definition of taxable income, which effectively made it a part of Oregon law through the automatic reconnection, even though Oregon had previously said we're not going to do that when it made a specific policy choice. But, of course, having gotten there, now it's there, and that leaves us faced with a 3/5 and 18 proposition and to disconnect. Very interesting.
Mr. Chair, you bring up a very good point, and that's exactly why we have the bill here. You'll notice that the add back is only for corporations, because that was the policy decision that you made in 1985. Right. The extraterritorial income exclusion actually extends beyond corporations now to include individuals, limited liability companies, S corporations, and partnerships. But those are not included in this bill because you didn't make a policy decision in that matter previously. So it is limited to corporations.
All right. Yeah, Representative Hess.
I was just looking in our tax expenditures book with Paul. This is listed in there as having limited benefit according to the Economic Development Department. And the cost of it is significant. I think it's, if you do it now, it's, what, Paul, $24
million? Well, I'm just but the revenue impact statement that we got from Elizabeth says 18. Is that just based on more current numbers
more
than what are in
time.
The tax expenditure report? Okay.
Well, fine.
All right. Any other questions for Deborah? We have some other witnesses here who will speak to us about this. And Deborah, you'll be around in case we want to call you back up for some follow-up questions. Okay. Let's bring up Jim Craven, Jonathan Williams. Harvey, do you want to come up? I've got three of you here, and I see you all sitting together. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to introduce Jonathan Williams, who's the new government affairs manager in Oregon for Intel. This is his first session here, so.
Be gentle. Is that what you're
doing? I didn't say it.
That's what I was thinking.
For the record, Jim Craven with the American Electronics Association. I think your staff and the revenue staff have, and all of you have done a pretty good job of getting your hands around this issue. It's lots of alphabet soup, lots of international trade disputes and international tax law provisions, and there's, you know, a lot of pieces to this. I think this is the week when, things start to get hard in this committee as you start to wrestle with some very fundamental Oregon tax policy decisions. You sort of warmed up with the general issue of disconnect, reconnect earlier in the week, and this is a subset of that debate. And I think it appears that you all realize that and realize that you know, this is a fundamental and a big issue. I do want to stress that this is not a trivial issue. It's not a housekeeping bill. There is a lot at stake here for many Oregon companies. And so, first of all, just realizing that this is not a cleanup, not a housekeeping bill, I think we've kind of established that. And I would urge that it appears that you don't plan to move to work session today, which we appreciate, because I think there is a complexity to this that that deserves a little more additional time, and that this bill needs to be looked at in the overall context of what we want to do with tax policy this session and economic policy. Because I just want to urge that this is not urge you not just to look at, well, if we pass this bill, we'll get $18 million. Yeah, but you'll take it from somebody, and that somebody is Oregon companies. In fact, the Oregon companies that are the export-based Oregon companies that are really the heart of our economic base, and as you all know, are struggling mightily right now in this state. I just want to harken back briefly to the policy statement I made a couple weeks ago in this room before you, that as we look at tax policy issues in this committee, we remember what is the actual structure of the actual Oregon economy, and that we not think of them just as, you know, divorced from the reality of this bill is a direct consequences to the high-wage, high-export-based companies that drive the Oregon economy, and should be thought of in that context, not just as a sort of extraterrestrial discussion of tax policy.
Extraterritorial.
Well, I said terrestrial on purpose. I had to get that in there today.
I don't think we've adopted an extraterrestrial.
We could probably use some.
There's no revenue impact.
Extraterrestrial income these days. I think the Department of Revenue did a good job of saying that in 1985, this body made some policy decisions about this tax treatment and whether we should be connected or disconnected from it. I would urge you to think of, we've changed lots of things since 1985. We've made lots of decisions. Every legislature really gets to make its own decisions and are not necessarily tied because this is how we did it at one point, that we must do it as we move forward, and that we ought to look at this in that broader context of tax, fiscal and economic policy for the state of Oregon and who the bill does impact. So I think that's the basis of my comments here today, that we are struggling. AEA is a national trade association. We are very involved in this dispute in Congress. There are billions of dollars of tariff punishments teed up with the European Union, not just on our industry, but a lot of American industries, if this doesn't get resolved by Congress. I mean, this is a very, very serious dispute. The default position right now is that the EU is going to levy billions of dollars of tariffs on American companies if Congress and the President don't address this. So this is way beyond the trivial in terms of its importance to the whole United States and to how we do export trade law in the United States. Part of our struggle here is hopefully we will be here for a limited period of time this session. We may not have perfect information about what Congress is going to do. We will offer to try to bring some of that intelligence to you when we have it from our people in Washington, D.C. about the likelihood over the next several weeks, if someone can make a prediction whether or not this is going to be addressed in time for us to make an informed decision here in Oregon about which way to go. Because, I mean, if it all goes away, it may become a moot issue. If it doesn't go away or if it's going to go away at a date certain, the revenue impact may or may not be higher or lower. So at some point we'll have to make that decision, and I would hope that we could delay it just a little bit till we have a better read as to what Congress intends to do on this issue and then how it will impact Oregon companies.
Thank you. Thank Question you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair.
who is that? Representative Hass.
Thank you. One of the issues we've always had to deal with on this committee is whether how far to go on a tax credit or a tax break before someone who might behave that way anyway with or without that benefit. Is there some way that you can quantify in terms of jobs or benefits in some way what this benefit does for your industry? I mean, can you lay out why it's good? I know that they like it. You told me that. I know that it's good for your industry. It's a savings. But is there a quantifiable way to say it's responsible for this many jobs or this plant, or is there a way you can help better explain why it's so necessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, probably the short answer is no, I can't tell you how the extraterritorial income exclusion leads to a direct amount of jobs in Oregon. That's probably not possible to do with almost any tax provision. And again, this is not an Oregon tax break. This is a set of federal tax provisions that do flow to Oregon companies depending upon whether you exclude them or not, connect or disconnect. The number, I guess, that has been scored by the staff is $18 million. I do not know today what portion of that is the high-tech industries. We're responsible for about half the state's exports, but I wouldn't leap to say so half the dollar amount, you know, is our industry. It all depends on whether companies use FSCs, their volume of foreign sales, and all that. It is passage of this bill appears to be an $18 million corporate tax increase in Oregon for the upcoming biennium. I think it's fair to characterize it that way and needs to be looked at that way. But as far as specifying the impact of any tax provision, federal or state, down to explicit this site in this city and these many jobs is probably impossible to do.
Representative Berger.
Yes. I wonder if you could comment on the World Trade Organization's impact on American workers and business, because obviously they're a huge player in what is happening here, and I think it would help me if I had a little more background on either the agenda here or why are we doing this dance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, which dance, the WTO?
Right, where they are coming in and just simply saying that this is illegal, and now Congress, and this will be the second time that Congress, is that correct, that right, they would have to respond? And so that may not be the last time. So I'm wondering if you could kind of give me an idea of what's happening here, because I think our concern has to be the impact on Oregon business, but also on the national scene.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I'm probably going to not try to explain the whole WTO. I'm not much of an expert on it, other than to say that, you know, it is a international structure agreed upon by a host of nations. This that covers all kinds of things, as you know. This specific issue arises because one part of the WTO, the European Union, decided to press its case on this specific issue and call this tax provision an unfair trade subsidy under the WTO framework. I mean, there's a policy dispute body. They went, you know, it's like taking somebody to court. They went in there. They made their case. The United States tried to make its case. Whoever that dispute resolution group is ruled in favor of the EU on this specific issue twice now. But beyond that, I'm not sure I'm prepared today to discuss the entire WTO.
But I guess following on that, though, Jim, and going back to your comments, this is something that is being dealt with in Congress even as we speak. That's the case?
Correct, Mr. Chair. One of the handouts is the from the administration's policy statement on it that basically says, we realize this is a huge issue, and it's not a theoretical issue. As I mentioned, these tariff penalties are teed up. I'm not positive on the timeline for their imposition, but you know, this is a multi-year dispute. The EU took us into the WTO on the FSC. Congress said, okay, we don't have FSC anymore. We have something different. They said, well, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's still a duck, and have prevailed. So Congress needs to wrestle with this year, but I'm not sure of their timeline or what the outcome of that's going to be.
And when you say this could be moot, I guess, is one of the options repeal by Congress, even of the EIT, as a way to avoid the imposition of these tariffs by the World Trade Organization? Is that one of the possible outcomes?
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. The issue that we don't know is, will the Congress attempt to at least still provide some kind of preferential treatment on this whole complex issue of export values and whether taxes flow back to the originating country. You know, this originally came up as a sort of a double taxation dispute that U.S. said our exporting companies were getting unfairly treated in the global marketplace, so we came up with this scheme, and now it's kind of circled back around to where the EU has made the case that we are unfairly subsidizing American companies in this dispute. So, I'm rapidly running out of my knowledge base.
You've already exceeded my capacity to comprehend. So, Representative Farr.
Thank you. I'm trying to put it in simple words that I understand, so correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me that this originated with the fact that that corporations operating in the United States were being taxed twice. They were being taxed by the United States and by the country that they're selling to. So, it's not really a tax break, it's just an elimination of double taxation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, that's my understanding of where this all began. Mm-hmm. I think it all began prior really to the WTO being in place and the EU being in place for that matter. And it's evolved to now a matter of at least one international body calling it an unfair trade subsidy rather than a level playing field type of you know, action. So
if I were to tell my son it's not a tax break, I'd be telling the truth.
Representative Shetterly, Representative Farr, certainly.
You would be telling your son what the United States told the World Trade Organization Dispute Resolution Commission. Well, I guess that remains in dispute, at least as far as the United States is concerned.
That's all I need to hear.
I guess one person's trade subsidy is another person's elimination of double taxation. That's how you look at it. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm there now.
if I understand what you said correctly, and again, I'm going to put words in your mouth and correct me if I misstate them. The United States may adopt, through Congress, may adopt a fourth plan. Or it might punt and say, okay, we give, we signed this treaty, which it contained these dispute resolution provisions. You've told us twice, and so we're going to accept it now. I mean, they could do either one of those two things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for Mr. Craven? Mr. Williams, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me this morning.
Now, I don't want you to be nervous. There's only about 10 people in the room, but I do hear that our internet audience runs into millions.
Oh, in your dream.
I hopefully it's using Intel processors. I'll follow up with. I'm the government affairs manager for Intel, and I'll follow up with Jim's comments with just a few things because Jim covered much of what I was going to say, which is fine. From an Intel perspective, Jim talked about what was going to happen with the WTO. We would face 100% duties on our products if the U.S. Congress doesn't address the issues with the current ETI. So we do expect that this is, not only is it being addressed right now, but it will come to some kind of conclusion at some point, because I do think that it's safe to say the U.S. Congress doesn't want American companies facing these kinds of tariffs on their products going forward. Secondly, from a disconnect perspective, the current ETI exemption is only carried out by 5 states. Oregon would be number 6 if they do indeed decide to disconnect from the ETI. Back in 1985, when Oregon was disconnected from the FSC, I think, and this is following up on what's already been said, I think it's safe to say that the Oregon economy has evolved quite considerably since that time. I don't know why Oregon made a decision in 1985 to disconnect from federal policy, but I do think that when things like the FSC and the DISCs that you mentioned earlier and now the ETI, why those are created is to encourage American companies to avoid things like double taxation and to encourage American companies to export, because we do believe that export-type jobs are high-paying jobs, good-wage jobs, the types of jobs that states like Oregon are trying to encourage. So when states disconnect from federal policy that's designed to support American corporations, we think that sends a bit of a negative signal to American corporations that are trying to, you know, grow jobs within this country. So going forward, I think it's important to my third and final point. However this shakes out, and I understand that the decisions that you make are not the kinds of decisions that Oregonians across the state envy, because they're terribly, terribly difficult. I think that the signal that this sends as far as an overall economic development program that the state's going to carry out, policies like this are sending the types of signals to corporations in the state. How is Oregon going to go forward? Are they going to encourage export-type industries? And, of course, that's not just Intel. That's industries across the entire state, from agriculture, timber, et cetera. Anybody that exports is affected by something like an ETI disconnect. Is Oregon going to join a very small handful of states that don't encourage these types of policies, or are they going to continue with the policy of the last couple of years, which is connecting to federal policies that are designed to support exporters in this country? So that's really all I have to add to what Jim had said.
Sure. Questions for Mr. Williams? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, there are some states that don't tax corporate income directly, are there not?
That's true.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So, in those states, at least, whether they're connected or disconnected doesn't make any difference at all, because they don't tax income directly anyway. Would that also be correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, not being a tax expert, my guess is that you're on the right track, but I don't know the tax policies of the 5 states that are currently disconnected.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just for perspective, can you name the states that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, yes, I can. Those states are California, Texas, Minnesota, Mississippi, and Hawaii. It is an interesting mix.
It's hard to identify a consistent theme in terms of where those states are economically and revenue speaking right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, for the record, Jim Craven, I would point out, though, that according to our national data, California and Texas are two of the three largest high-tech states in the United States as far as high-tech employment.
All right. Harvey Matthews.
All right. Thank you, Chair Shirley. I come here representing Associated Oregon Industries, Harvey Matthews. AOI began 1895 as an organization to promote Oregon products, and AOI is a business organization today that represents over 20,000 Oregon businesses. So I want to specify right at the get-go, this is not a high-tech issue. This is an Oregon business issue, and AOI certainly is a good representative sample of what the business community believes about this issue. Oregon is an integral part of the world economy. One in five of Oregon's manufacturing jobs come from international business and trade. And of all states, Oregon ranks in the top 10 in both export dependency and exports per capita. In the last decade, Oregon exports increased nearly 130%. And the top export markets, as I've listed there, include Japan, Canada, the Philippines, China, Korea, Malaysia, Taiwan, Singapore, Germany, and Mexico. And our exports that we send out to these various countries are widespread. Electrical machinery, of course, is number one, but machinery, cereals, medical instruments, vehicles, wood products. So what we have here is a very complex economy based largely on exports. So our problem, why we oppose House Bill 2182, is that it would have the net effect of discouraging foreign exports. And due to this fact, AOI's position is that it should be tabled indefinitely. Conversely, given the status of Oregon's economy and the need for new jobs, by hopefully would consider legislation that would expand the number of incentives for companies that export goods. As the Department of Revenue discussed, this is a policy issue, and I would think if you're going to implement a multi-million dollar tax increase, exports probably wouldn't be the focus. In fact, going on what you said, Chair Shetterly, I think with the multi-million number of people that are watching us right now, perhaps we should put advertising on our website to probably offset this cost. So that will summarize my comments.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Matthews?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I still have the same question. That is, could you somehow quantify what this benefit means in terms of jobs, in terms of feedback into the economy, in terms of, I guess, asking what the state gets for the money that is taken out of the Treasury to pay for this?
I cannot give you an absolute answer. 20% of our jobs are tied to international trade. What percent of those jobs benefit from this particular tax incentive? I really don't have the answer to that. But, you know, some percent, certainly.
So what?
Some percentage of that, probably a large percentage. I will do my best to get exact figures for you on that matter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I'd like to just follow up on that very briefly. I think that's a very interesting question. I don't think I've ever seen an analysis that's taken a single piece of tax policy and tried to quantify job flow related to that. I think it's an academic discipline that would be interesting to see. I guess the only thing that I would add to this is anytime you have a situation where new industry, and I know Oregon is doing a lot to try and attract new industry. Nanotechnology, for example, is a commonly discussed thing. So if you look at nanotechnology as an example, if you were to try and start nanotechnology and exporting products related to nanotechnology, you would look at a wide range of issues when you decide where to locate. Those would include things like cost of living for employees, quality of education, multiple other things. Taxes might be one of those things that you look at. Now, if you were to decide between, say, the Seattle metropolitan area or the Portland metropolitan area for this, the Washington County area or Seattle, for this particular industry, if Seattle is advocating policies that are tied to federal policies which are designed to support companies that are exporting, and Oregon is tied to disconnecting from these policies which are designed to support, I think that would be a negative for Oregon's attempts to attract new industries which are export-oriented. So I don't think you can quantify it based on looking at companies that have already made commitments to the state of Oregon, but I do think you could look at it from the perspective of new industries in this state that are weighing multiple factors would see this as a negative for the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond, and I can't disagree with that at all. It's just that we're at this, I guess you might call it, crisis point in this state's history, where if you want to talk about economic development and incentives, the fact that Portland is chopping a month off of its school year, I think that is seen as a much bigger negative than whatever tax policy we're talking about here. And so I guess it's all relative. You know, 5 years ago, I don't even know if this would have been an issue, but I think we're at a time and place where when we are emptying out mental health facilities, when we're chopping off school years, when jails in Multnomah County are releasing inmates because there's not enough money, I guess some of these have to be looked at more carefully, and that's all I'm saying. And where is some data or some quantification for the benefit returned? I mean, maybe this pays for itself, maybe it pays for itself and dividends, but if it doesn't, then I think we should be extremely careful about continuing some of these. Mm-hmm. And this is one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I absolutely concur with your characterization of the crisis the state's in, and I don't think anybody in this room or anybody up at this table would disagree with the fundamental and probably unprecedented and historical challenge that the state faces at this very moment today, this week, next week, and upcoming months. So I don't, you know, I don't want this to be seen as people being sensitive to that at all. And your statement about good schools are important to economic development, good social services are important to economic development, are all absolutely true. You know, my only pitch is that we put this bill in that context. That this bill be in the general context of the very fundamental decisions we have to make this session about tax policy, economic development policy. Do you tip the balance to increasing employment so we can have high-wage jobs so people can pay 9% of the personal income tax and we can refill those coffers? Or do you, you know, break every piggy bank in the struggle to find every dollar because the need is real? There's not a right answer on, it's not a black and white issue at all. And, I mean, our only point is this one needs some additional talk, as well as a lot of other bills that we're going to face in this room and other places in this building. And we're certainly sensitive to, you know, every comment you made. And if the issue is data, we can come back and provide data about how a manufacturing export-based economy has helped fill those coffers over the last two decades in this state. And how, you know, all the economists, you can bring Joe Courtright in here and he can do a slideshow about how a fundamental export-based manufacturing global set of companies in this state has been the only reason we didn't die after Measure 5 passed. And so, you know, we employ 75,000 people in high tech at an annual salary of about $75,000 a year. That's a lot. You know, 9% of marginal rate on top of that's a lot of dollars that flow into the state. We have billions of dollars of exports that flow through the Oregon economy, and it's part of that structure that has kept us afloat. Now we're saying that it wasn't enough because we're also suffering because of the global economy and our, you know, reliance upon that. And these are fundamental questions, and we're going to be wrestling on them for the next several months.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Farr, then Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. In our effort to quantify what $18 million means to the economy of the state, really there's kind of a continuum. At one end of the continuum is 270,000, $75,000 a year jobs. At the other end is $18 million in somebody's pillowcase someplace under a bed. And obviously it's neither one of those, it's someplace in between. And I understand the difficulty in quantifying a single source of money in the economy. You know, what exactly does it mean? But
I'll go back to a statement that you made earlier, that the $18 million, if we choose to grab it, it's not just $18 million that's floating around. We're taking it from somebody, and the people we're taking it from are Oregon-based corporations. I'm correct in that assumption, correct? And I'm assuming that in that they are Oregon-based corporations, that a certain percentage of the $18 million of profit that we would be taking away from them is reinvested in the Oregon economy. I mean, someplace in between the pillowcase under the bed and the 270,000 jobs, money is being pumped back into the Oregon economy. And I really appreciate what you said last, Mr. Craven, in that you know, we do have to take into account all of the problems that we have inside of the state. But do we want to break every single piggy bank in trying to fix them? I just don't think so.
Take a swing at that slow pitch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I appreciate your comments. You know, I said to my wife this morning, thinking about what I was going to say here today, is that, you know, our job is to advocate on behalf of Oregon employers and the bottom line of our Oregon companies who are trying to employ people, compete in global marketplace places, and pay high wage jobs. I mean, you have the unenviable position of balancing that versus the need for paying for services and the overall budget picture. I mean, so we're going to sit up here and advocate on behalf of our employers and thinking that the dollars that we keep in our companies helps create high-wage jobs and pay good personal income taxes the state relies on, and your job's going to be to balance that with the needs of the overall state and all the other issues that you have to wrestle with. So,
Representative Barnhart, you had a question.
Thank you. Yeah, this is on the same theme, I think, as Representative Farr's comment. There's an assumption that's stated clearly in the first line of the Mr. Matthews' handout of under problems associated with HB 2182, which is that it would have a net effect of discouraging foreign exports. I think that one of the things this committee needs to do as we examine these kinds of business taxes, and this tax in particular, but other taxes on business in general, is the extent to which that net effect is true and the size of that net effect, whether how important it is or unimportant it is. And I want to give just one example of the kind of issue I'm talking about. The founder of Amazon was recently criticized for establishing his business in Washington because of the business taxes in Washington, which result in him paying, or his company paying, hundreds of millions of dollars, well, many millions of dollars, I'm not sure the exact number, in Washington state taxes, which he would not have owed had he been in Oregon, because he hasn't had any profits, and therefore he wouldn't have had to pay an Oregon income tax. His response, of course, was that in Seattle is where he could find the particular workers he needed to operate this new web internet-based company that he had, and therefore with the tax scheme that the different tax plans of the different states have was far less important to him than these other factors. And I think that's the kind of question that that this committee needs to deal with. And I think I agree with your characterization that it's a balancing. But I think as a part of that balancing, we need to understand how important this particular factor really is. I think one of the things that's happened in Oregon lately, based on my very limited experience, is that we assume that it's an extremely important factor and then go on to look at other things. I want to challenge that. I suspect that in some cases it might be an extremely important factor, but I suspect that in many other cases it's only one factor among many and a relatively unimportant one compared to the other attributes that companies look at when they choose to locate or do business in Oregon. And I think that's the kind of question that at least you've heard the three of us on this end of the table comment about, and which we could certainly use a lot more data on.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, fair comments.
Anything else? It's a good discussion. All right. Thank you three very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one thing. It was 27,000, not 270,000.
Okay. That's fine. Anybody else wish to testify this morning on House Bill 2182? We will have it back up again sometime, but while we're here today, anybody want to speak on this. Deborah, would you come up? I do have one question for you that I want to try to get my head around. This will be a question for you and for Elizabeth, too, I suppose. Understanding that this is in flux in Congress, and Congress may take action even while we're in session, I suppose. Assume this scenario, just so I'm not predicting anything here, but just so I understand what some of the outcome might be. Let's assume that we pass our other whatever bill, and that is where we do the disconnect, effective as of December 31 of last year. We defer action on this. Okay? That leaves that bill, then, if we move forward with that bill, that leaves in place the connection to federal treatment of extraterritorial of the extraterritorial income exclusion. Okay. Then let's assume that while we're still in session, let's say, I guess it doesn't have to be, but let's assume then that we don't take action on this. Congress repeals the EIT exclusion. We've disconnected. What happens then to the treatment of extraterritorial income for the purpose of Oregon income tax, where now Congress has repealed it, but we don't have, this is sort of the other side of that disconnect coin. How would the department regard EIT then? For Oregon purposes.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. We look at the Internal Revenue Code as it is in effect on December 31 of 2002. So if Congress were to repeal the exclusion, that income would be restored for federal purposes.
Right.
However, for Oregon, you would need to go back to what federal law was on 12/31/2002, and those rules would say you have an exclusion. So on the Oregon return, there would be a subtraction.
So that's interesting now. But, of course, at this point, corporations are keeping track of this EIT for the purpose of their federal taxes, and so it's a natural, it just flows naturally. If it's repealed for federal purposes, then are companies, corporations, going to have to nevertheless keep track of some EIT calculation then for Oregon income tax purposes in order to take advantage of the exclusion?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct, yes. They would need to calculate federal taxable income under the rules in effect on 12/31/2002. And in order to do that, they would need to know what that exclusion would have been under that law.
Okay. All right, I just wanted to know. Yeah, Representative Bruton?
You want to... somewhere I got lost. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, because this is an important question.
Yeah.
Be real specific here, if you could. If we disconnected on the other bill, okay, and did nothing here, what would that mean for Intel in terms of what they would have to do that's different or the same? And if the federal changes, the third piece, the third leg you just talked about, okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the disconnect in House Bill 2186 would say when you figure Oregon taxable income, use the federal rules that were in effect on December 31, 2002. We don't care about any changes that occurred after that date.
Right.
So go back, look at federal law, and calculate your Oregon taxable income. If Congress, after 12/31/2002, makes any change in federal law, that is not effective for Oregon purposes. Right now,
We disconnect.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
If you disconnect. Okay. Right now, it says that income is exempt for federal tax, and our connection says it's exempt for Oregon tax. Tying to the provisions as they're in effect on 12/31/2002 means that exclusion is going to be written into Oregon law because that's what's in federal law right now.
Okay.
When they say the exclusion goes away for federal purposes, that has no effect for Oregon because we're back here at 1231-2002 using those rules, and under those rules you had an exclusion. So federal law, you will be taxed on the income as it flows to the Oregon return. You look at that and you say, okay, the rules on 1231-2002 said I got to exclude that income, so I'm taking a subtraction for Oregon purposes.
Okay, got it.
I just wanted to make clear that is the other side of the disconnect coin. Right now, because the federal policy is leading us into deficit territory, we think of disconnecting as a way of avoiding losses of revenue. Disconnecting also, though, works the other way, where federal tax policy would have the effect of increasing revenue to the state. Disconnecting doesn't bring that revenue in unless we go back and affirmatively disconnect to those or connect to those changes as well.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There is another option, and that would be to create a specific exception in House Bill 2186 for certain things that you want to have continuing conformity. And you have done that in the past with net operating losses and with pension plan items. So that would be another option to you.
Yeah, that's I appreciate that. That's good. Other questions? Discussion? And we're not going to work session on this today.
This feels like a consent calendar.
Yeah.
In spite of your aggression.
Yeah, I might be inclined. No, I want to thank Lizbeth and Deborah and our panel of witnesses today. This is tough stuff. I think, Jim, I would agree with your comment that we're getting into heavy sledding here as we go, and it's not going to get easier as we go through the session, but these are good issues to begin to work our way through. And as much as I can, as we have with this and the other disconnect bill that we heard earlier, we are not going to rush to decisions on these. I think they do take time to contemplate and consider. So with that, I guess to the extent that Representative Barnard, you've requested some additional information. We'll see what develops there. But for now, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2182. And, Paul, I think we are not going to meet tomorrow. We had a meeting scheduled tomorrow to have some further discussion on tax policy and education financing. We had invited State Superintendent Castillo, among others, to come speak with us. But immediately after floor session tomorrow, we have our workplace harassment lecture. And then I know there's a House Republican caucus at 10 o'clock. So between those two things, it would be difficult to squeeze a meeting in tomorrow morning. So we will not meet tomorrow, so I will adjourn now until Monday morning, and we'll be back to work on Monday.